you, and I think I can look after her just as well on the farm as I can anywhere else. There's food and shelter there, medical facilities, electricity, clean water, and a lot of my friends will still be there.
It'll be a different place now, but I think you'll be able to make it.
Good fighter. Smart leader.
Clarissa smiled at Jack.
You could stay with us, Jack.
The teenager considered the offer, but shook his head.
Had wife, child once. No more for me.
He looked at the others in the wag.
Stay with France.
I understand. Anyway, I'll have a niece or nephew to take care of in a little while.
I wouldn't be surprised if you have one of each to contend with.
Mildred looked at Melanie.
Girl, you are ready to pop.
Overhearing the friendly banter, Christy leaned closer to Ryan and put her head on his shoulder.
Strange, huh?
What is?
Life.
What's strange about it?
Well, even here in the Deathlands, where death and destruction are a part of the everyday routine, life still finds a way to carry on.
They said their goodbyes and turned the wag around. A little less than half a tank of fuel remained. It wasn't enough to get them anywhere significant, but it could at least get them someplace safe to spend the night. They could all use a little rest before moving on to the nearest redoubt. The Fallsville was a good bet. If nothing else, they could take the time to admire the falls. Although a mere trickle compared to what it had been in pre-dark days, the flow of water was still pretty impressive. JB shifted the wagon to gear and headed out. When the wag was gone from the farm complex, and he was sure the Outlanders wouldn't be returning, Norman Bauer stepped out of the shadows of the woods across the road from the front gate. He climbed onto the road and stood there waiting with his ledger under his arm until two Sekhmen came out of the woods to join him. He looked up at the sign that read, Fox Farm. It had been riddled by blaster fire, and the second F was about to fall from its perch. He was going to change it anyway, he thought. Bowerville suited the place better. After all, that was the name of the man who'd really been running the complex these past few years. But while he was lost in thought about how he was going to be the new Baron, something rustled in the trees. Before he even had time to focus on what was happening, a huge amorphous shape took out both Sekhmen at once. In a panic, Bauer turned to flee, but was too late. The last thing he saw was his ledger falling to the ground, its dusty pages ripped out and fluttering away in the wind. Shiva assumed her previous form of the canine humanoid mutie she had employed for Clarissa's benefit. She knew that after today she would never see her again, and was sorry that the girl she had briefly befriended would never know the true identity of her mutie companion. But the Skydark spawn had a mission, and she couldn't stop until it was carried out. She would have to find these amazing strangers again. Her very survival depended on it. She could already feel the life force draining from her. She didn't have very much time left. Perhaps J.B. Dix or the pre-dark physician Mildred Wyeth could help her find a way to extend her life so that she'd be able one day to find the enemy and vanquish them and finally be at peace. Or perhaps not. Maybe it was destiny for someone else to accomplish the mission that she had failed to do. Maybe it would be these strangers as they continued to roam across the Deathlands. Or maybe it would be the undertaking of future Outlanders. Only time would tell, of which she had very little. She resumed her normal gelatinous state and set out after the companions. Keep listening for a special preview after these announcements. Eerie remnants of pre-dark times linger a century after the nuclear blowout, but a traveling roadshow gives new meaning to the word chilling. Ryan and his warrior group have witnessed this carny's handiwork in the ruins and victims of unsuspecting Vills. Even facing tremendous odds does nothing to deter the companions from challenging this wandering death merchant and an army of circus freaks. And no one is aware that a steel-eyed monster from the past is preparing a private act that would give Ryan star billing. Deathlands 62, Damnation Roadshow. Deathlands Skydark Spawn is a Cutting Audio production. Copyright 2005, The Cutting Corporation. Performed by Richard Rowan with Terrence Aselford, Colleen Delaney, Nanette Savard, Timberly Chanel, Thomas Penny, Christopher Walker, Kate Torrey, and Mort Shelby. Directed by Rick Rowan. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Vocal editing by Matt Webb and Brian Patton. Sound design by Brian Patton and Dan Smith. The Deathlands theme was composed by Mark Ashby. If you enjoyed Deathlands, be sure to look for James Axler's Outlanders, available at roadstops everywhere, at 1-800-670-5220, or at www.cuttingaudio.com, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free screensavers, ringtones, and games. From Outlanders 23, Far Empire.
Hit the bird at the same time? Why not? Let's do it.
Keane's Mantis ship tipped up on the starboard wing and banked away, arrowing in on the death bird from the left. Grant's fingers squeezed the triggers on the control stick just as rockets flamed from the wings of Keane's craft. Grant fired off two mini-sidewinders. The combined missile barrage hit the death bird amidships. To Grant's surprise, the chopper split in two a second before its fuel tank exploded. The craft sideslipped to starboard and plummeted straight down as if it had been dangling from a string that had been cut. The rotor blades fanned the air sluggishly, even as it plunged toward the ground. Grant pulled back on the stick to avoid colliding with the spray of flaming debris. His Mantis ship and Kane's roared by on either side of the thick column of smoke, leaving such a whirlwind in their wakes that plumes of vapor followed them like accusatory fingers. As he reduced his ship's speed to 100 miles per hour, Grant's ears started buzzing. He recognized the sound as the radar lock-on warning, piped from the forward sensor array into his helmet.
Hear that? Very clearly.
He punched a series of numbers into the flight control computer, trying to achieve a fix on the radar emitter.
We should have known they'd beef up the perimeter defenses after the last time we were here.
A red square of light suddenly appeared on Grant's HUD, superimposed over a small grid-enclosed area of the terrain. Simultaneously, the warning chime sounded. Then another red glowing square appeared and the chime bonged again. From the lake bed, two cylindrical 10-foot-tall towers arose, sand and pebbles cascading down from their domed tops. The towers rotated, the laser targeters mounted on top of them popping on, following the Mantis flight path. Protruding from four oblong slits on each side of the towers were multiple blaster barrels. Grant stared at the image of the Vulcan Phalanx gun housings on his helmet display. The rotating, multi-barreled weapons fired uranium-tipped explosive shells at 6,600 rounds per minute. The Vulcan Phalanx system was a standard defense of the network of Vils stretching across the length and breadth of the country. The housings were automated, containing tracking and firing control radars. He and Kane had seen similarly camouflaged emplacements before. Flickering spear points of flame erupted from the slits of the housing. Kane's Manta lurched to port as a shell exploded in a flaring shower of metal and flame against the tip of its starboard wing. The fragments rattled noisily against the fuselage of Grant's ship.
Climb!
Applying full throttle, Grant pulled the tab into a steep climb, the Manta rising so swiftly and sharply that it appeared to be standing on its tail. The maneuver created a force equivalent to three times that of gravity, but the pilot seats instantly compensated for the increased pressure. At the apex of the ascent, with the airspeed decreased to 30 knots, Grant pushed the stick forward and nosed the Manta into a steep dive. The cockpit resonated with the high-pitched whine of the stressed ramjets and the slipstream of air sliding around the hull. He dropped the tab rapidly to an altitude of barely 50 feet while increasing its airspeed to 120 miles per hour. Absently, he saw Kane expertly duplicating the maneuver. Both men leveled off their crafts, and the Mantas hurtled forward, skimming the rocky ground, leaving streams of grit swirling in their wake. The thudding hammer of the Vulcan Phalanx guns continued, and Grant knew the few seconds' respite from the radar could be counted on the fingers of one hand. The tracking controls would reestablish their lock at any second. His fingers hovered over the nose-mounted cannon trigger, and his HUD automatically adjusted the CGI crosshairs, superimposing them over the image of the gun turret. The warheads of the cannon shells contained incendiary properties, and the immediate result of an impact was a flash fire. If the projectiles struck a flammable target such as a fuel tank or ammunition, it would cause them to instantly explode. Grant achieved target acquisition and squeezed the trigger. A stream of armor-piercing steel and tungsten carbide shells punched a cross-stitch pattern in the dirt in front of the housing. The lines of impact scampered across the lake bed, flinging divots and tongues of flame in all directions. They intersected with the base of the tower, penetrated the metal, and the explosive warheads detonated. The Vulcan Phalanx gun tower was swallowed by a billowing red-orange fireball.
You want to take the other one, or should I give you the birds? All things being equal, I'll give the birds my undivided attention.
Although he was sorely tempted, Kane didn't fly.